Here's a pop quiz, pun intended. What popular carbonated soft drink was originally marketed under the name Bib Label Lithiated Lemon Lime Soda? The answer? 7-Up. The drink was launched in October 1929 and originally included a small amount of lithium citrate, which explains the name. That's just one of many obscure soda facts in Tristan Donovan's book, Fizz, How Soda Shook Up the World. Doug Gordon sat down with him to uncover the secret history of soft drinks.
Tristan, we can't really talk about the history of fizzy water without talking about what gives it its fizz, the carbonation process. Who discovered carbonation?
Joseph Priestley was the guy behind it. He was a scientist and theologian in Britain in the 1700s. People had been working their way towards it. They had worked out what carbon dioxide was and how to make it. They'd discovered there were minerals in water, but no one had worked out how to actually make the water fizz. And he lived in the city of Leeds, and near his house was a brewery. And he went in there and started doing experiments over the vats where the beer was brewing, which produces a lot of carbon dioxide. And he started sort of moving water back and forth between two vessels. And by doing it quickly enough, he managed to start capturing some of the gas inside the water. So that was kind of the big breakthrough. And then he developed the special apparatus for pumping the carbon dioxide under pressure into the water so it got trapped there, sort of using a pig's bladder to kind of pump it.
Did he think that, in keeping in line with the mindset of the time of fizzy water having medicinal properties, did Priestley think it was possibly going to offer some sort of cure for something?
Oh, yeah. He thought he had made this wonderful breakthrough in healthcare. One of the first things that happened after he revealed his apparatus is they gave it to the explorer James Cook to take on his ships for his voyages around the world. And the thinking was, by having the ability to make fizzing water on the journey, they'd be able to cure themselves of scurvy and survive the journey. So they thought it was a massive breakthrough. James Cook's ship didn't get scurvy, but that was because they were taking in fresh fruit whenever they stopped. So it was a little disappointing for him that it wasn't anything to do with the fizzing water, but they still believed there was something good about it.
What is it about the fizzy water that people enjoy so much?
First of all, the drinks tend to be sweet, and we do like sweet things.
Yes.
But also, I think it's just a bit more interesting than your normal drink. If you're just going to drink water, it's fine, it's nice, but it's fairly plain. All these drinks had kind of all these bizarre tastes, and, you know, it was much more exciting to have it fizzing. Mm-hmm. So I think it was just more attractive and more fun, and so people bought into the idea that, well, it might not cure all my illnesses, but this is fun to drink and tasty and sweet and, you know, great on a cold day. I mean, a warm day.
Yeah. And then it makes me think also of the line from Bubblicious or some other chewing gum, there's a party in my mouth. So it's like having a party in your mouth.
Yeah. And you got the tang of the phosphoric acid, that little kind of bite you get in Coca-Cola and so on. And, you know, the bubbles fizzing on your tongue. So I think it was sort of quite, you know, and even in the 80s when I was growing up, it was still quite a magical thing. It was quite unusual to, you know, you have fizzing lemonade. And it was like, ooh, what's going on in my mouth?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Defending the world from tyranny, paving the road to victory. Coca-Cola leading the charge.
When the U.S. entered World War II, Coca-Cola executives managed to convince the American government that Coke was this kind of liquid morale booster. And by September 1942, supplying the troops with Coke had become basically official U.S. Army policy. And when the U.S. sent 20,000 troops to the British island of Trinidad to protect it from attack by the Nazis, and the sight of the troops with their Cokes and the way they were going after the women inspired this local calypso singer named Lord Invader to write a protest song. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, basically he saw all these American GIs with their Coca-Cola and drinking lots of rum and Coke, because rum was sort of the big liquor there. And essentially he kind of felt, you know, they're wooing the women away from us. So, you know, there was this kind of envy, and they had money, which the local people didn't really have. So it was really kind of, you know, these Americans are coming in and they're taking away our women, and they've got all this money and we don't. So it's a bit of a protest song.
And when the Yankees first went to Trinidad, some of the young girls were more than glad. so that the Yankees treat them nice. And they give them a better price. They buy rum and Coca-Cola. Went down Point Kumana. Both mothers and daughters working for the Yankee dollar.
Right, ironically, he didn't have much success with the song himself, but the Andrew Sisters covered it later and it became a hit.
If you ever go down Trinidad, they make you feel so very glad. Calypso sing and make up rhyme, guarantee you one real good fine time. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola, go down Point Kumana. Both mother and daughter working for the Yankee dollar.
Yeah, and then one thing that I was surprised to learn, that it was kind of reworked a bit. And according to Wikipedia, when it ended up in the hands and recorded by the Andrew Sisters, because the song was plagiarized by Maury Amsterdam, the guy who's probably best known for playing Buddy Sorrell on the Dick Van Dyke Show. Is that right? And Amsterdam copyrighted it, and then the Andrew Sisters rejigged it, and it became this huge hit.
Yeah, it's bizarre to sort of have this basically a song that started off as this sort of almost anti-American protest kind of go up to the top of the charts.
Well, I guess by the time the Andrew Sisters reworked it, it wasn't considered a protest song, because if it were, I would think Coke would come out with its protest song to protest the protest song.
Yeah, yeah. I think they may have intervened if it stayed in its original form.
Working for the Yankee dollar.
In recent years, we've seen the emergence of small soda and this craft soda movement, small operations like Jones Soda, Brooklyn Soda Works, and Wisco Pop here in Wisconsin. What are these artisanal soda makers doing differently from Big Soda?
I think what they're doing is bringing it back to the producers. So it feels local, it feels small, it feels more natural than this kind of slightly sterile cans that roll off by the millions from the production lines everywhere. You see it in all different types of areas of society at the moment, that people are trying to get back to what's real rather than this big manufactured experience, which is what Coca-Cola and Pepsi ultimately offer. So lots of people have been kind of going, well, actually, it's quite easy to make soda. The equipment's quite cheap. I'll give that a try, and then I can experiment with new flavors, and we'll do something weird with ginger and celery or whatever it may be. And this been picking up, and so, you know, sort of local food markets and things, it sells them there. And I think it feels more individual to people. It feels less like, oh, if I buy Coca-Cola, it's, you know, I'm just one of many millions of people. But if I buy a drink from Brooklyn Soda Works, then, you know, it's more individual to me.
And then Jones Soda, one of the early craft soda companies, and they've been around a while, and maybe they're too big to be considered part of small soda, but they've done interesting things. Like when they first started, they invited consumers to send photos, which they would use as labels on the bottles, which of course really helps develop a sense of ownership. They've had some crazy flavors, haven't they?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Sort of meat flavored sodas and things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, turkey and gravy for Thanksgiving and oh. Yeah, all kinds of crazy things.
Yeah, and there's some appeal in it, and just like, I know it's going to be bad, but how bad is this? I'll give it a try.
You got to try it. Yeah, it's the gross out factor.
Yeah,
impress your friends by how willing you are to be a risk taker and try turkey and gravy soda.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Tristan, do you drink soda?
Yeah, I do. Mainly Coke Zero, but I do like kind of quite a range. So I don't drink it as much as I used to.
I'm curious about the future of soda. I wonder if maybe we've reached peak soda, a time when big soda sales are going to continue to decline as people become more aware of the health risks, and a time also when the craft soda movement may grow and take more market share away from big soda. What do you think about the future of soda?
Yeah, I think we've passed peak soda quite some time ago. In 1998 was the height of soda sales in the US.
Okay, so we're post-peak.
Yeah, and it's been in steady decline year on year ever since. So the sales are definitely dropping. We're moving to water. We're moving away from soda. What I think the craft soda movement may do is pretty much like what's already happened with craft beer. People start moving away from kind of what would have been Miller Lights and Coors or Budweiser or whatever it was, and going for these more craft type sodas. And they wouldn't have them quite so often, but it'll be a more interesting drink to have. And I think that will happen, and that will chip away a bit more. But I think it's the health worries and the worries about putting on too much weight that are driving most people to reduce their soda consumption.
The girls' girl watchers watch what they drink. They watch for true cola taste and watch out for aftertaste.
Tristan Donovan talking with Doug Gordon. Tristan's the author of Fizz, How Soda Shook Up the World.